Chapter 9. Malaghurst. Silence closed over him like a hand. The red-edged clouds had become featureless black, the sound of the wind an echoing stillness. He breathed and heard the sound fill his ears. He took a step. Cold, damp stone met his foot. His armour was gone. He felt rough cloth scratch his skin as he moved. A staff was in his hand, ready to take his weight as he took another step. Pain ran across his back, and he winced as he moved.
"None of this is real," said a voice in his head.
And then another voice answered,
"Whatever makes you say that? Just because it does not follow the same rules, that does not mean it isn't happening."
There was no sign of Horus, though. Just the dark and the sound of his own breathing. The sensation was different, though. He had just two lungs and one heart. Mortal again, if only for a while.
"Sire," he called. "Horus!"
Echoes answered, rolling out and back into a space in front of him. A cave, then, or chamber. He took a step, feeling the damp on the water-smoothed stone and steadying himself on the staff. Horus would be here. He had to be.
"Does he?" came a thought.
He blinked. There was light in the distance, small and cold, but light. He moved towards it, slipping and nearly falling on the uneven floor. The light grew. It was not flame or the glare of a stab beam or lumen. It was a slow-spreading glow that crept along the wet stone. Malaghurst kept his eyes on it as he worked his way across the cave floor until he could see its source. He stopped. A black pool of water crossed the cave floor, running from wall to wall. The water was so black that he would have thought it an opening into an abyss, were it not for the moon shining from its surface. As he watched, a drop of moisture fell from the roof and scattered ripples over its face. He looked up. The ceiling of the cave was crystal-threaded stone, without crack or opening. The pool was narrow, but barred the way to the opposite side, with no path around the edge. He moved to the bank and bent to test the water with his fingers.
"Are you sure you want to do that?"
Malaghurst jerked up, stepping back from the pool, staff in both hands and ready to strike. A figure stood on the other side. It was a man. Loose skin hung over withered muscle, and the hair that hung to his shoulders was white in the reflected moonlight. His back was straight, though, and the time that creased his face had only etched his sharp avian features sharper. For a second, Malaghurst did not recognize the face, shorn of the genhancements it had worn in life. Then recognition pulled a name from his mouth.
"Yacton?"
Yacton Cruz shrugged.
"If you like," he said.
Malaghurst noticed the figure's clothes then. A long tunic of grey-white hung from Cruz's shoulders. Blood stained the fabric. Malaghurst could see the sharp spatters from blade cuts and the dark blooms from deep wounds. A torn leaf of parchment sat on his chest, pinned in place by the broken-off tips of knives. A single word had been written on the parchment in a slashing, spattered hand. "Murder," it read.
"A warp spirit," growled Malaghurst. "A conjuring of demons wearing the skin of a memory." "If you prefer," said Yacton Cruz again.
His eyes were empty holes, his gaze the blank stare of ancient statues. All of the lore that Malaghurst had learnt and mastered on conversing with creatures of the Immaterium clicked through his mind. He was seeking Horus, to pull his master back into the world of the living. He was walking the paths of the warp now, of dreams and metaphors, and the warp was twisting the task into something older and more deadly. He had to be cautious.
"You are searching, Twisted One. Searching beyond the bounds of your strength and ability."
Cruz stepped forwards and bent down next to the moon-silvered pool. He extended a hand and slowly touched the water with his fingers.
"But you can still have answers if you wish. What is the price?
Said Malachurst. A suspicion was forming inside his thoughts, but he kept it unformed, the idea hidden in fragments. The subtleties required to lie to men were nothing compared to the deception of demons.
The price, said Cruz. You should know that, brother. For where do we stand? And what is this water before us? Chthonia, he said,
putting a name to the idea that had come to him as soon as he saw the cave walls and the black pool. He looked at the disk of the moon, hung beneath the rippling surface. He thought of the Mournival and of the splinters of old customs that had been embedded deep in the Legion for so long that only now did their roots in darkness seem obvious.
The door of becoming, he said,
then flicked his eyes up to Cruz's empty stare.
The toll taker, and...
He reached up to his chest, and his fingers found the leather pouch that hung around his neck on a thong. He pulled it free and shook the contents into his palm. The single, shining mirror coin gleamed like an echo of the water-drowned moon.
The price. Are you the one I called?
Asked Malachurst, lifting up a hand to show the silver-engraved coin held between his finger and thumb. It was an old piece of lore from the deep tunnels of Chthonia, given new power by the craft that Malachurst had learned. The crossing coin, a gift paid to bind a guide to take you through the unknown. Blood and the engravings on it gave the coin a presence here in the warp that was stronger than in reality. Cruz did not move.
You understand, he said.
The words a statement rather than a question. Malachurst looked at the wolf's head on the silver disk. He tilted his hand and it became an eye, the pupil a slit.
My soul, he said. All that I was and am have fought to keep from the warp while others give themselves to it. That is the price, said Cruz,
and held out his hand across the water.
That is always the price.
Malachurst nodded, closing his fist briefly over the coin, then opening it again. The silver was bright on his fingers.
Yes, he said. Of course it is. I understand.
He tossed the coin into the air. It tumbled, eye and wolf winking as it fell, struck the face of the moon and shattered it. Cruz darted forwards, hand plunging beneath the water to catch the coin as it sank. Malachurst's hand clamped around Cruz's closed fist.
I understand, snarled Malachurst.
Cruz tried to pull back, but Malachurst held firm. A syllable of power came from his lips. The cave walls trembled, the water of the pool churned and boiled. Cruz, or the thing that held that shape, was shaking. Boils formed and burst on its skin.
I understand,
he said again, and spat a string of syllables into Cruz's face.
Lyak placed you here, knowing where the path would lead. This is how you snare me, how you get to sink your teeth into my soul, how you get to place another slave by Horus's side.
The face of Iacton Cruz was distorting, the image of flesh bubbling and melting. His jaw cracked and elongated. Black fangs grew. Fur and feathers burst through split skin. Its body swelled, muscle expanding beneath grey flesh. The demon roared in his face. Spittle and blood spattered his cheeks.
You are fallen!
Roared the demon.
You are already fallen! You are already meat on the table! You have no choice. The only question is who holds your leash. You have no power over me. I gave my soul long ago.
Malachurst tightened his grasp around the creature's hand, the hand that still held the coin that was the mirror of the real coin that hung around his slit throat in the real world, the coin that was burning into the demon's essence even as it tried to let go.
I gave my soul to Horus Lupercal,
he said, and spoke the final syllable. The demon screamed. The coin was sinking into its flesh, burning and charring skin and bone. Malachurst released his grip and stood.
The demon twisted beside the pool, then went still. Its jaw shrank. Skin closed over quills and fur. When it stood up, it looked as it had before. Its right hand alone remained blackened and twisted. The skin shriveled over the claws of fingers. The silver coin sat in the palm, fused with the blackened flesh. The demon seemed to breathe for a second, and then looked at Malachurst.
You will pay for this. What is your name?
The demon shook its head.
You have bound me. What need have you of my name?
Malachurst smiled thinly.
That I know what to call you. Give me your name.
Amarok,
said the demon.
And you will be my guide, Amarok, just as you promised but never intended.
Malachurst indicated the pool.
Lead me to Horus.
I have no idea what you are asking.
I do not care.
Very well,
said Amarok, and bent to breathe on the water. The moon vanished, and now there was just darkness, its surface no longer holding any reflections. The demon stepped back and indicated the pool. Malachurst moved to the edge and then looked up at the demon. Black spaces looked back at him.
Why did he wear this shape?
He asked.
Of all the faces you could have taken, that old fool is one that means very little to me.
He gestured at the parchment still pinned to its chest.
And his death even less. We are all old men, Mal,
said Iacton Cruz's voice. Amarok smiled and gestured at the pool.
After you, my master.
Lyak.
This place is an abomination,
snarled Lyak. The paths before him branched and curled away like the insides of a conch shell. They had stopped running a length of time ago that he was not certain he could judge. They had moved through spaces that he was certain were larger, vast and echoing places that pressed down on his senses, even through the concealing mists. Gravity obeyed a simple, perverse law. Down was whatever surface you were standing on.
Or it could be seen as a marvel, said Actea.
She still had the crystal bulb of blood in her hands. Every now and then she would lift it to one of her eyes and press it to the socket.
The webway deceives. But is not deception sacred? Do not the righteous need to be tested?
It defies us,
he snapped.
And anything that defies should be torn down? Is that not rather short-sighted?
Your questions are...
Perceptive, said Actea. I would have hoped that one who has amassed so much power under the sight of the gods would value perception.
I value only what serves the gods.
You lie,
she said and shrugged. She was moving her head from side to side, her face occasionally twitching.
Not that way,
she said, pointing down one of the passages, but not moving to take the other branch.
I do not lie.
You lie all the time. Your essence begins with lies, and any truth you find is a rarity. You lie. So does everyone. So does Lorgar, but more to himself than anyone else.
Lyak went very still. She looked around at him and shrugged.
I speak as I see,
she said.
That is what my duty is.
Duty to whom?
The truth, she said. Ultimately, that is what we serve, isn't it? Not primarchs or emperors or war masters, but the truth of the universe.
The gods,
he began.
You call them gods, and the title serves, but they are just an expression of truth. It does not matter if we kneel to it, if we offer prayers, or if we loathe it and despise it. The truth is eternal and claims all.
You are a heretic!
Kulnar and Hebek had put their hands on the hilts of their swords.
No,
said Actea, unmoving. The blade slaves paused in their movement.
I am the part of your soul that is missing, hollow one. The part that wonders why Lorgar despises you yet keeps you close. That wonders why you have no real name but chose one from a book. Why you are a slave who does not even know what master holds his chain.
Actea shook her head.
What? She said. Do you think that you should kill me?
I have done more for less cause, said Lyak.
Yes, at least that is not a lie. You cannot kill me. You are already lost, and you need me just to survive in here. And you should not think that this truth-speaking is a weakness. It is a necessity. The webway is not a labyrinth of tunnels. It is a labyrinth of the mind. It listens. It breathes in the secrets from those that walk its roads. The same path walked by different souls will lead to different places. Maps here do not mark branches and turns. They mark the shape of the soul that would reach its destination. She grinned. He noticed that her teeth were polished points of silver. Why do you think that you and your brothers became lost? You are hiding things from yourselves. All of you.
There are spirits in here, said Lyak, shaking his head. Powerful and unbindable.
Those that have been lost to the roads, said Actea. Souls who will never leave.
More ghosts, growled Lyak.
This is a realm of ghosts, Hollow One. You should feel at home.
Lyak was about to snarl a reply when a sound breathed across his senses. He raised a hand.
Do you hear that? Said Lyak.
Kulnar twitched beside him. Hebek hissed something that might have been a word if the mouth speaking it had had a tongue. Actea froze, her face creasing into a frown.
I hear nothing, she said.
Sound in the webway was flat. The clink of their weapons did not echo, and the buzz of their power armor had no depth. Lyak turned slowly, aware of the itching in his nerves where the phantom had slid its hand through his flesh and armor. The sound came again, breathing from the left-hand path in front of them.
I heard the clash of swords. Bolt of fire.
There have been battles in here since its birth, and creatures fight and die in it still, said Actea. Sometimes you can hear echoes of those clashes from halfway across the galaxy, and far into the past.
Perhaps, said Lyak. But that was neither. He began to run down the left passage. The existence of the right-hand passage folded out of being.
Bring her!
He called to the blade slaves. Actea was already following Lyak, red robe billowing behind her. Kulnar scooped her up, overtaking her in a single bound. She hissed in anger. Lyak ran. The mist was pulling back, the tunnel hardening and unfolding in front of him like a flower opening to sunlight. He took a step and stepped into a place of fire and slaughter. Volk.
He is healing at a rate that is inconsistent with the standard properties of his physiology.
The voice was a drone of static and turning cogs. He breathed, tasted iron.
I was unable to remove portions of the damaged armor.
Another voice, too distant to hear, clearly, but familiar in tone.
No closer to rapid regeneration and sinew fusion, although there has been an alteration to the metallic structure of the...
The voice that interrupted remained just out of hearing. He could not see, but flashes of orange light bubbled in the darkness. Flashes. Darkness. There had been the light of fire, bright splashes in the black, stitches of bullets and lasblasts in golden and silver thread. He had been riding into the teeth of the enemy, and the heat of his machine around him had been like the red roar of blood. The displays had been red, the pulsing red of warning, of damage, of fire. He had...
What happened?
He asked, and his voice was a gurgle and gasp of fluid and cartilage.
You disobeyed orders, said Argonis,
his voice now close and clear.
You took leave of sense. You came as close to dying as I have seen someone who is still alive.
I cannot see.
The remaining biological ocular sphere was lost with the right upper portion of your skull. The augmatic in the left portion is still functional, though deactivated. I can reactivate it at your command.
Do so,
said Volk. There were things clicking in his chest, like the rise and fall of levers. His world filled with static. Pain lanced into his skull and exploded in a shriek of migraine-bright light. He did not cry out. The taste of iron was thick in his mouth. Ghosts of green and blue light blurred into being in front of him. He was suspended upright, the central node of a web of chains, tubes, and wires. The web twitched in time with a rhythmic suck and hiss that crept into his ears. Below and in front of him stood a tech priest, a mass of metallic tentacles flexed in place of its legs as it came closer. Discs of eye lenses rotated beneath its cowl.
"Perception achieved,"
it droned, in its voice of static and cogs. "What happened out there?" asked Argonis, stepping closer behind the tech priest. He was still armored, and his eyes were hard in his unscarred face. Volk saw the flicker and bloom of armor bursting under the deluge of fire, and then the momentary flower of rupturing fuel cells, fire swallowing the breath of air that fed it, and he felt the heat again, and tasted it against his teeth. It tasted of iron.
"I do not know," he said.
Argonis looked at him for a long moment.
"They had to cut you from your craft. What little there was left to cut out."
He paused.
"I have seen kill frenzies before, seen a human pilot fly through a war cloud of fighters, clawing them from the air until his cells were dry and there was nothing more than air in his lungs to scream in rage before he died."
He moved closer, looking up, and Volk saw that there was something that might have been pity in his eyes.
"But you are the Iron Talon. Not a mortal strung out on stims and combat hours until you can't see what's real. So what happened?"
"Iron within, iron without." The litany circled him, and in it he heard an answer. "Iron has one desire," it said. "It dreams of whetstone and rasp. It lives to be a killing edge." Volk tried to shake his head, but could not. The tech priest skittered closer, adjusting something out of sight. Volk's head lolled and then rotated.
"Where are we?"
he asked. Argonis glanced at the tech priest, then back at Volk.
"Sarum," said Argonis.
The tech priest flinched, looking at Volk and hissing steam. Argonis did not respond.
"You have slept long, brother."
"And you wake me now?"
"No," said Argonis. "You woke as soon as we dropped from the warp at the system edge and came within range of its outer defences."
Volk felt the words buzz through his mind. Argonis had placed a weight on them, as though waiting to see how Volk responded.
"How did you know when I woke?"
Volk asked. Argonis gave the slightest shrug, the smallest shadow of a smile at the corner of his mouth.
"I was here," was all he said.
Volk would have blinked, but his eye was a machine, and he realized that he could not feel his face.
"What happened?"
he asked.
"We survived," said Argonis.
"Show me,"
said Volk. Argonis hesitated and then nodded, glancing at the tech priest. Images and data filled his sight. He saw. He saw the bloated ships explode and burn as they closed on the Iron Blood and its sisters. He saw the rest keep coming, vomiting ordnance at the Iron Warriors until it seemed that they swarmed the stars. He saw the iron-hulled ships grid the darkness with fire, each volley coordinated, measured, so that the spinning diamond of ships seemed one entity obeying a single will. The enemy kept pressing, heedless, until the first breaches into the warp opened and the Iron Warriors drove back to the storm. The sensor data blinked to black.
"What did they want?"
asked Volk, as the image of Argonis returned.
"The creatures that claimed to be your Legion brothers. They were not of the Legion. Whatever they were, they must have known that they could not face our guns and prevail. What did they hope to achieve?"
Argonis looked at Volk for a long moment.
"I do not know," he said.
"When the fleet returned to the warp, the storms had dissipated, blown clear, as though making way for us."
"The warp. Your brother. The one who claimed to be your brother claimed to speak with the voice of the warp. The War Master has harnessed the warp. It answers to him. No other speaks with its voice." "After all I have seen of the warp's hand in this war, I wish that I could hear that and believe it."
Argonis looked as though he was going to reply, but then gave a shake of his head and looked away.
"Atarabo goes to meet the Red Priests of Sarum at the gates of their realm. I must go to be there,"
Does the Primarch summon me?
He asked, and then realized that it was a strange question. Argonis shook his head. Again the tech priest flinched and muttered a clatter of sound.
If you are going with him,
said Volk, noticing that strength was replacing static fog in his nerves.
Then I go with you. Get me down from here. Get me armored.
That request falls outside of my current advised parameter,
began the tech priest, lens plates spinning several times.
Augmetic integration is not complete. Mind interface linkages have not taken. The machine does not bless your animation.
Volk laughed. The tech priest slithered backwards. Machines murmured out of sight. Argonis stepped forwards.
You should see,
said Argonis softly, and gestured at the hissing tech priest.
Show him.
The tech priest hesitated, and then began to turn dials on a brass-cased box he took from beneath his robe. The image filling Volk's sight vanished, so that now he was looking at a cable-wrapped lump hanging in a web of chains. It held the shape of a torso, but only just. Its limbs were gone below the elbow and knee joints. The metal of pistons and connection sockets gleamed amongst the flesh. Servo arms moved around it like caressing hands, spraying a mist of counterseptic from tiny nozzles. Pieces of blackened metal clung to the flesh in places, fused by bulbous pink scar tissue. The head was a lump of iron, held on a cog ratchet neck. There was a cooked, wet look to the meat of its body, and a film of iridescent corrosion covered the exposed plasteel and chrome. It did not look like a space marine. It did not look like him.
Fit the augmetics,
he heard his voice say.
Bring me armor. Make me walk from here.
The tech priest looked at Argonis again.
The Lord Primarch did not
do it, said Argonis. Under the authority of the War Master, do as he asks.
The tech priest complied. They took his sight away while they worked. There was pain. He endured it. He walked from the arming chamber with a hiss and snap of pistons. They had not been able to fit him into a standard suit of armor, so they had desecrated a suit of tactical dreadnought plate. It had been Tartarus pattern once, but modifications had to be made to accommodate his flesh. He had begun to heal. They had told him that they had not been able to remove some of the augmetics that they had fitted first. His flesh had not allowed it. His first steps had juddered agony through him, but by the time he reached the launch bays, while he still felt pain, the feeling had a different meaning to him. He no longer cared that it hurt. They had given him weapons, a bolter and a chainsword. Neither felt as they should in his grip. He had supposed that was to be expected. His hands no longer had flesh to feel. Another whispered thought, which lurked behind the pain of iron and flesh, said that it was because the weapons had never taken life. They were dead, unblooded, without a song to sing. Perturabo looked at him as he crossed the deck. Ranks of iron warriors waited in front of the open ramps of gunships. Volk slowed as he drew near his Primarch. The iron circle's targeting eyes washed over him and did not snap away for several seconds. Argonis walked at his side, armed and armored, the Eye of Horus held in his right hand. Volk began to kneel, pistons hissing, as he waited for the censure to come from his lord's lips. The Primarch gave a single shake of his head before Volk could lower his body. The iron circle parted as Volk approached, and closed behind him and Argonis as they followed the Primarch into the belly of a stormbird. Only when the gunship was roaring and shivering through the void did Volk break the silence.
They did not dispute your right to come here, my lord.
No, said Perturabo, looking away to gaze into the dark. They were waiting for us.
Volk heard the words and felt a shiver pass through his piston and metal-sheathed flesh.